If you're especially vulnerable, protection against COVID-19 is priceless. The good news is spring COVID-19 vaccinations are free if you're age 75 or over or immunosuppressed. Get your vaccine as soon as you're invited. Be wise. Immunise against COVID-19. Find out if you qualify at nhs.uk.
This is our People podcast, telling the stories behind South Tyneside and Sunderland NHS Foundation Trust.
Welcome to our People podcast. I'm your host for this episode, Rob Harnaby. I'm Director and Manager of Medicine at the Trust. On today's episode, we're at the offices of Gateshead Council and I'm joined by Mark Smith, Director for Public Sector Reform and Senior Responsible Officer for Changing Futures, Victoria Hansen, Touchpoint Operational Lead for Changing Futures, and Roisin Burdiss, Lead Alcohol Specialist Nurse at the Trust. So to start off, I'll come to you, Mark, if you could just tell us a bit about the Changing Futures project, sort of when it started and what it's trying to achieve.
Yeah, hello. Thanks, Rob. So Changing Futures Northumbria is a four-year project. It started as a three-year project, and it's jointly funded by the Department of Levelling Up, Housing and Communities and the National Lottery. And its focus is on adults with multiple and complex needs. So, but I think in particular it's on people that, for whatever reason, have been largely failed by the ecosystem of public services that already exists. That's not just your trust or any trust, it's councils, policing, probation, mental health, NHS, more broadly, everything. It's where the combination of whatever is out there has not worked for quite a slew of people who routinely present to multiple services at great cost and doesn't seem to work. And I think the government acknowledged this and thought, well, rather than just trying to tweak things, we need to experiment, and that's how it came about. So they asked for expressions of interest back in 2021, and then during lockdown, well, certainly back into lockdown, and I put a call out regionally to see if people wanted to get involved, and because we'd already done a lot of work in Gateshead on helping people very differently, and loads of people came forward, loads of partners, including your trust. So we set it up, put a bid in, and we got given some funds, and we've been working ever since on that same group of people and across Northumbria on four sites, including the alcohol care team. So that's essentially what it's all about.
So you mentioned the multiple complex problems. Mm. So what was the main purpose of the touch point with South Tyneside and Sunderland?
Well, what we wanted to do with this work was to take the premise that whilst people present at different settings with different issues, the issue they present with is seldom the only issue, and it's often not even the main issue. So what we wanted to test was if we were to set up four different touch points in different sorts of places, even though the presenting issue requires a degree of specialism, the fundamentals are broadly the same. So the government specified that they wanted people that had a combination of five things, at least three of them, but we decided we weren't going to screen. We would just go to places where people like that were likely to show up. And those things were around alcoholism or substance misuse and alcoholism, addiction recovery, engagement with the criminal justice system, issues with mental health and domestic abuse and homelessness. So all of that stuff was kind of the area where we were looking. So the four sites we've got are around women's services, one around homelessness, this one, and one in accident emergency in Gateshead, which wasn't in the original design, but that's where we've ended up. And what we see is when people do show up at those different places, many of the issues are broadly the same, and that has massive implications for public services and how they operate. So this one came about because there was interest in it from within the trust. Somebody came forward and various conversations were had, and this came to the fore. So it made perfect sense to design something around alcohol in this particular trust.
Okay, and in terms of the main activities, if you like, within the project, what does that look like from setting it up.
Yeah, so the premise of this work is that if you look at people that routinely show up to services like alcohol care team and to homelessness and all these other services, there's a pattern. And we know this from work we've already done previously. So we know that when people show up, a number of things happen. Initially, they'll be screened, and one of the things that will look, they'll take a view on is, are you bad enough? And if you're not, come back when you're worse, because eligibility is a bit of a thing. And then when they do come in, they get assessed according to the discipline that they've showed up at. But they don't really get understood. So what our work does is it says, okay, we're going to just ditch all of that and base it on what are now three rules, and we're going to scrap everything else. So the rules are, don't break the law and don't do any harm, and agree purpose with whoever we're working with, why we're doing this. And there's a series of principles around understanding people and not assessing them, making sure we don't just refer people on left, right and centre, that we try and hold the ring on the case and pull expertise in rather than just palm people off, that we make the decisions in the work by people doing the work rather than people like me and officers like this that don't really know what's going on, and that we don't have arbitrary time limits, and I've forgotten what the other one. Oh, and the scope of the work is determined by the relationship between the caseworker and the citizen. So what happens is somebody rocks up, and if they agree to take part, they'll be given, allocated a pair of workers, one of whom will be a peer support worker that has some lived experience, and the other will be a caseworker with a more professional background, and Tori will say a bit more about this, I imagine. But and what they'll do is they'll work with that person where they're at, and that's how it works. So when you say what specific activities happen, the answer to that is it depends. It completely depends on what that person is, where they're at, what matters to them, what matters to them right now, what matters ultimately. And we work just a day at a time, a minute at a time, you know, and it sort of creeps along and aggregates. And what we find is a lot of what the team do is very much around utilising existing specialisms and skills and pulling on different bits of the system. But a lot of it isn't. About half of it is around stuff you would never commission. So it's around time, conversations, going for a coffee and talking about what needs doing, or helping them attend an appointment because they're a bit nervous, or countless things which seem small but are material, and if you don't do them, you'll generally fail. So the team are very, very sensitive to the, we call it bespoke by default. They work bespoke by default. There's no pathway. There's no protocol. There's no procedure, which I know unnerves some people. There is essentially a relationship that is built, and everything works on the basis of that relationship, and it really does get results. So that's what the team do. We don't prescribe specifically what they do. We create an environment in which they can do those things. And they also have a budget which they can spend on whatever needs to be spent within reason. So that's broadly how it happens.
Great, thanks, Matt. So I'll probably take the opportunity talking about the team to turn to Tori in terms of the Touchpoint team. What's your role within that and the Change of Futures structure?
Yeah, I'm the operations lead for Change of Futures, so I look after operations across the four Touchpoint sites and manage majority of the staff within that. So we have, like Mark said, we've got two members of staff working on the women's service. We've got four members of staff within the QE's emergency department. We have six members of staff in the homeless project in Gateshead, and we've got six in Sunderland and South Tyneside within the alcohol care team. So it's the day-to-day running of that, including the staff supervisions.
And the staff are quite a mix, aren't they? Where have you derived the staff that have formed?
So we've got the staff. We've got staff from six different organisations, so it is a mix. So I think, I mean, Mark would probably tell you more, but the idea behind that initially had come about from having different specialists within the team. So we've got caseworkers with a variety of different backgrounds. We had someone from probation, occupational therapy, a domestic violence expert, someone from substance misuse, someone from housing. So we've got we've got mental health nurses on the team. So there's a range of different specialist experience within the team, and we've also got a number of roles within that of peer specialist support, which is lived experience. So people who've been there, they've been through the system. A lot of the peer specialists we employ in 12-step recovery. So it's that we've got a broad staff makeup of lots of different experience from lots of different areas, and it complements each other. We've set it up where the work in pairs predominantly, where we've been able to do that. So we buddy up a caseworker who's come from a professional background, and a peer specialist who's got the lived experience, so they work in pairs. And which has been really helpful for a number of reasons. Obviously, firstly, risk. That's massively helped with that. But also, the people they're supporting get a multitude of experience. So they've got the lived experience can be brought in as well as the professional background experience. And also, that helps the staff. That's been a big thing that's come out that I don't think we thought about in the beginning when we were setting it up in pairs. But this is heavy. It can be heavy work. You're spending a lot of time with people. It's intense.
Because they weren't in pairs at the start, were they?
We've
evolved. It's a learning programme, so we've evolved that feature.
And I think the feedback we've had from the staff that are now working in pairs is they can feedback. You know, they almost have like a little reflective practice on the way home. You know, they debrief with each other and they say what went well, what didn't go so well. Is there anything we would have done different today? In a very natural way, not. So that's the setup of the touch points.
I think that's the thing that struck me when I first, you know, being used to being a manager of services, professionals, nurses, doctors, is that the emphasis was they were case workers rather than what professional background they've come from. So, I mean, how does that benefit in terms of the work that they've got to do or the circumstances they find themselves in?
From my point of view, the distinction that you make around they've got this background, but we're not asking them to do that. They just happen to have it. They've got professional background, so they're used to casework, I suppose. But we're not asking the caseworker that's a CPN to come here and be a CPN.
Yes.
We're asking them to come here and be a caseworker. And so they're doing the same job as the probation officer that came in to be a caseworker, that the housing person came in to be a caseworker. Now, those backgrounds aren't material as to where we put them. They just happen to have those backgrounds. Now, if those skills need deploying, great. If they need to pull on skills they don't have, they can pull on them instead of referring. I suppose what those backgrounds can be helpful, I mean, this is at a very abstract level, is that people that have worked in the system doing a role will be aware of its limitations. So you'll get people, like I remember we had a probation officer with us from the start, and he used to say, there's so much about my job that I find frustrating that I don't hear. And because he's aware of those frustrations and he's aware of those limitations, he appreciates the value of having a broad remit. And he goes for it. It's energising. And being in a job like a probation officer does expose you to the rest of the system, so you can navigate it quite well. So it brings that advantage. But what we don't want to do is constrain the thinking by dint of the job they bring with them. So it's almost like leave your job at the door, but bring your skills in. So that's worked really well. So the advantages to them having that specific knowledge, I would say it's relatively small.
Yeah.
You know, it's not often, is it? I mean, Tori, correct me if I'm wrong, where someone's background happens to be nailed onto the issues that the citizen has, so they can just deploy their specialism. They, by and large, they're able to just to work with them on the stuff that is more generalist. But having been in the system, they're aware of how it works and they're aware of who to pull on. And having that range is great. People can cross-fertilise and learn from each other. But we haven't really designed it that we wanted a probation officer, a CPN. We just wanted people with different professional backgrounds. And we haven't really got hung up on exactly what they bring with them. I mean, what makes people good at this job isn't their job-related knowledge. It's their empathy, their resilience, the skill, their sort of skill in building relationships, thinking laterally. The skills are qu- quite secondary, I would argue. Don't know.
Yeah, and when we've advertised, we don't advertise for a specific skill.
No.
It's just likewise with lived experience, that can come from anywhere. Mm. There's people with lived experience of domestic abuse, of substance misuse of all sorts, and the same with the caseworkers. It's not, we wouldn't advertise for it, we're looking for a mental health nurse. It just so happens that that person's been attracted to that post and it is the generalist, but they will bring that work experience with them. Like Mark said, they'll know the system, they'll know how to navigate that.
I can imagine if you're in the health system and you're listening to this, you're probably thinking, whoa, that sounds a bit risky. But the important thing to bear in mind here is we're not forsaking the system. What we want to do is navigate it better whilst building relationships that the system wouldn't build. So you've got a caseworker and a peer support worker working with somebody that has been bouncing around the system for many years. I mean, one of our people has cost £2 million on his own because he's just routinely bouncing around. And we've worked with him in that way, and a fraction of that cost, and he's clean, he's sober, he's stable, he's living somewhere, he's chairing AA meetings, he's really turned it round. After years and years and years of, well, heading towards death at high cost to everybody, including him, obviously himself. And this has worked for a reason, because it's built upon his abilities and capacity as well as that of the system and the people in it. So it's not about forsaking specialism, it's about using it really sparingly, pulling on it when you need it. Just so happens that when people do this job and they've got a specialism, they kind of know how specialisms work. So that's an inherent advantage, more so than the particular specialism that they're bringing with them.
Yeah, and I felt I need to ask it because it's a norm, particularly as a healthcare manager, to just anticipate that's how things work. So the fact that they were caseworker first, whatever profession second, was something that it's a little bit confronting as to
and
how
it's
does
quite
this...
a distant second, I would say.
The more
we've done this, the more we've recruited on aptitude rather than skills, I would argue. I mean, I don't know if that's the right way of putting it, but that sense of knowing what makes people good at this job isn't what they know, it's how they interact and how they are and how they look after themselves and each other. I think that's massive, and it's a big thing that's missing. When you look at people that have cost a lot of money over the years and failed on multiple services, it's the absence of that that accounts for a lot of it. It's not the absence of specialism. There's enough of that, plenty of that. It just hasn't worked.
We've had lots of discussions, haven't we, around recruitment. This is it's more values-based as
very
opposed to competency-based.
That's exactly the way of putting it. Yeah, it's values-based. It's
people
not
who are good at this are people who really care, who want...
Because some people are brilliant at being a specialist, at dealing with something at face value, using their skills that are hard won, lost training, and deploying those skills day in, day out. We need people that can do that, but we also need people who can understand context, work on the gritty details. It's different every day. That will appeal to some people and absolutely won't appeal to others. And we've had people, it's just not worked. We've had a couple of people where it felt right when they applied and it just didn't work out. It's really not for everyone, but it is for many people, and they're the sorts of people that are attracted to this. And they're disillusioned with the current system, or they're just minded to work this way. You know, it's a bit of a mixture.
I think that another thing that's important to point out with the roles is there's no difference between the lived the peer support specialist role and the caseworker role. They're paid equally. They other than one's got lived experience and the other's got come in through a professional side of it, there is no difference. They do the same job. They're equals in that role.
That parity is unheard of, isn't it? It's really, I've never heard of it before, because normally lived experience is often something you kind of set up a group and you talk about to a lived experience group in the abstract occasionally, and say, okay, we've had some input from people with lived experience, and then you carry on deploying your specialism. But what we found that's at best quite tokenistic, and at worst sends you in the wrong direction. If you're going to use lived experience, you need to use it in the work, and if you're going to have it in the work, it needs to be a role. And there'll be stories, which I'm sure we'll tell in a minute, about how having lived experience in the teams has been material to people's transformation.
Yeah. And you know, you mentioned one example, and I think we really want to get into some examples and some patient stories, and we had a bit of discussion about using the term patient, because it's a trust health podcast, but now you're used to working with citizens and service users, so we'll try and navigate the naming conventions. But in terms of the process, I'll probably start with Rasheen, just to sort of guide us through to the examples. Was how do you and your team, Rasheen, the alcohol care team, how does that link, what does that look like in terms of working with Tory's Touchpoint team?
So obviously the whole team knows about the programme, and when we are assessing patients and working with them when they attend obviously A&E or they're an inpatient, we then discuss the programme with them, and then obviously if they're happy to engage, we'll obviously, I normally discuss that with Tory, and then they are selected. Obviously we'll bear in mind when we're thinking about who's appropriate that they have one of the multiple disadvantages, so obviously alcohol, substances, homelessness, domestic violence, mental health, and it tends to be a lot of the patients that we see frequently that are, we've kind of got a floating waiting list, I like to call it, of patients that have would be suitable and are wanting to engage in the programme, because obviously we do explain to the patients that it is a learning programme, it's not another service or another referral we're doing, and obviously that they do have to want to engage in it. And then obviously I speak and have meetings with Tory frequently, as well as the caseworkers and the peer support workers, we speak to them all the time.
Yeah, because I guess there's still potential for them to attend hospital, attend DD, which is where you're usually being put into contact with them and referred to. Just how, what's the response been like? So is there a kind of a proportion that have just said, no, not for me, sorry, kind of leave me alone with this one? Or?
Yeah, I think there's a small minority of patients that didn't want to consider the programme, weren't interested, but then there has been the other side of that where there's a lot of patients that do want to and have engaged in the programme. I get a lot of professionals asking us to refer patients into the programme that they've got, that they've heard about the great work and they want their patient to be in it. But yeah, and I think each patient's different. And again, patients that have worked in the programme, their work has been has all been very different.
Yeah, because clearly you work with, and this is where you work from Tory, is the recovery programmes. So they're going in a different direction, or as well as those programmes already being in existence. I think, as we said, you know, we want to sort of discuss some examples where we've seen a change in the patients. It might be that, you know, like you said, the frequent attenders are less frequent attenders, or that they're just, as Matt described, that their life will have changed. Have you got a particular one? I know we might have a few, but a particular one that you wanted to share in terms of who they are, what they look like. And
yeah, I think one of the patients that were referred right in the very beginning, obviously I had known her for a very long time, having managed the gastro ward at South Tyneside. She was frequently attending A&E. Obviously there was alcohol and substance misuse, domestic violence. There was quite a lot going on, it was very chaotic, so she was referred into the programme, and I think it was up and down for a good while, but I think up until the point where I had referred her in, within a 12 month period I think she had had over 90 either admissions or presentations to the trust, and then
there was a 90 something arrests as well.
Yeah,
she was well known to criminal justice system.
Yeah, she had quite a lot of to do with the hospital security team, and she had certain markers and incidences. But I think from after maybe 4 months, I haven't seen the patient since at the hospital.
It's been well over a year, hasn't it?
Yeah,
since came back to the. The hospital.
So she's had no further attendances at our hospital, at either site, because she attended both South Tyneside and Sunderland.
Yeah. So in terms of kind of going, so obviously you're not seeing them anymore, you're not seeing this lady. What does that look like from the Changing Futures side? Because there are work will be going on.
Yeah, I've done a lot of work with this lady. She's, like Roisin said, she was one of the first to start on the programme. And at that time had a number of hospital admissions, a number of arrests. She was known to 14 different services at the time when we started working with her, but not actually engaging with any services. So whilst there was a lot of attempts from a lot of people in the system to refer and to get her the support that she needed, that wasn't successful at that time. It took us a while to build the relationship with her. And interestingly, just when you were saying before about people who want to come onto the programme, it is interesting, a lot of the people who have come onto the programme have been the people who aren't engaging with other services. So it's so I don't know what's been different of why they've wanted our support. But yeah, so it took us a while. She had a caseworker and a peer support specialist working with her, and they just took the time and they just didn't stop. They just kept contacting her, seeing if she wanted support, and we got there eventually, and she started engaging with them, and it starts like you're building the relationship. So it is just cups of tea, some meals, walks, just getting to know her, things that she'd said no one had ever done before, because usually it's an expectation that there's a referral put in place, but then she'd have to get there at a specific time and day, so that was, it's a very different approach in terms of that. And we have the workers have done a lot of work with her. She's doing absolutely fantastic at the minute. She was homeless at the time. So one of the biggest challenges we had was getting her housed, because at the very first meeting I went to with professionals, we were told she was unhousable. So she has been barred from every hotel, support accommodation, refuge in the whole of Sunderland and South Tyneside. So that was a big challenge. But she has just recently secured her own tenancy. So we did some really good work with South Tyneside Housing, and eventually got her, we're just getting her into her own property just after Christmas. So that's fantastic. Like I say, she hasn't had any arrests in that time. She had a really bad wound on her back that needed looking at. One of the biggest issues that she had was sustaining any period of time in hospital was difficult because of our presentation. She was quite aggressive, quite angry, she could be violent. So the caseworkers did a lot of work around keeping her calm in hospital when she was having to go for planned appointments and her planned operations. There was a lot of work around that, and I think that was only possible because of the relationship that built with her. So that was great. So she managed to get this really important operation that she needed, but it was life-threatening. Trying to think of what else. Do you know, I was just thinking about this lady this morning, and we've been working with her just over 18 months now, and she's in such a different place to where she was. She's not drinking, she hasn't drank for a number of months now, but she does still, there is still substance use issues, which she's now starting to address. But I think the biggest thing that everyone thought at the time was she had to address the substance misuse, the substances. And it's strange that that's actually the last thing now that's being addressed, because there was so much else going on that she wouldn't have ever been in a position to address the substance use without a secure roof over her head. The pain she was in was unbearable, so that needed to be sorted. So there was a lot of other things that had to be done, and before she could get the help she needs around the substance misuse, which is where she's at now. So they've done, but this has been intensive work. This has been like hours a week spent with the lady. But they've got a really good relationship with her, and like I say, she is just doing fantastic. And I think in terms of what you said, like, she hasn't been back to hospital, and when she was coming to hospital, it wasn't anything meaning. It was, I think from what we gathered and from working with her and what we've learned, is it was loneliness, a lot of it. It was that the hospital was somewhere that was open 24 hours a day, so it was somewhere she could turn up to and she'd know she would see somebody, a familiar face. So within no time, that had stopped when she got the support from her caseworker and her peer specialist, because she would ring them And that started quite chaotic in the beginning. Like, she would ring multiple times a day, but that soon, once she realised they were gonna follow through with what they said, when they said they would see her tomorrow, they would see her tomorrow, then that reassurance and that trust was built.
I think there's a few of the patients that I've referred in, obviously at the point of referring them, my team was seeing them daily, if not weekly, and then now there's a good handful of them that I don't see anymore, and I know when I don't see them that they're doing well, and it's because obviously a lot of the needs and help and support that they needed is not something that we could give them from in our team from that point. It needed that longer term and intensive support, which the team Touchpoint does.
Yeah,
and I guess let's call it the outcomes that she's achieving, those fact features of her life that are present now, I guess they wouldn't have been anticipated at the beginning, like you say, that first meeting with the professionals.
No.
If they were told 18 months hence,
absolutely
she's
not
going to be in accommodation, she's not going to be attending.
And we've heard from a number of professionals now have said they've never seen her as well as what she is at the minute. And to be honest, the only reason we ended up getting her housed and she's got her own accommodation at the minute is because of the work that the Change in Futures team did, because we were working with her so intensely and they could see such improvements in the way she was behaving when she was coming to appointments and coming into the council, they were able to then think out the box, because they were out of options, but they really could work really well together to say, right, we'll give this a shot. But they were only able to do that because we were there to do that. They don't have the resources to do that intensive work alongside it. It needed both to go hand in hand. We needed the housing to think, to sort of bend the rules, think outside the box a bit, and they needed us to be there to ensure that she had that additional support, because it wouldn't have been sustainable without that.
Yeah.
And you know, the work we're doing now, it hasn't stopped. We're doing now around maintaining this tenancy, and you know, that's a huge thing for someone who's never had their own tenancy to then, which is doing really, really well.
Yeah, and I think that's one feature I was just going to bring Mark in about, a feature of it you mentioned, you don't stop working with these individuals, that you have that ongoing contact. But certainly when I first have heard of this, and you know, we'll make this assumption repeatedly, is that sounds like an awful lot of cost and time. But in terms of how, you know, what does that, you know, look like for you in terms of...
Well, I can tell you what it looks like when you look at it system-wide, and what it is a bargain. When you consider and we've got the data, so we had to get about 14 different data sharing agreements to get all of the historical consumption data for the people that we're working with across various NHS trusts, probation, policing, councils, the lot, but we got it, and we've mapped it all out. And there is absolutely no business case for carrying on as we are. So when you look at that and you think that sounds expensive, it kind of does, because it's intensive and it's time rich and it's very contextual. But if you look at it through a traditional efficiency mindset, which we tend to do in public services, and you just look at the amount of interactions, and the focus is on making those interactions, each of them efficient, but they don't work. So when you tot it all up, it just adds up to thousands and thousands of interactions, thousands and thousands of hours of very compliant, you know, inspection compliant, clinically sound, I suppose, input, which is devoid of context and doesn't work, or it serves to alleviate a minor issue. So one of the things that Tori mentioned before was that whilst the presenting issue ostensibly is around alcohol, say, the actual issue is something much more fundamental. We talk about the iceberg of presenting issues versus issues that are really material, and loneliness is absolutely one of those. In fact, there's three broad things. It's around somewhere to live, something to do, and someone to love. And that love isn't necessarily, we're not talking about romantic love necessarily. It's someone who's got your back, someone who's bothered about you. And when there's nobody else, it's us. So we get all sorts of comments about, well, that's an unhealthy dependency. And what we're saying is, no, it's not. Initially, it's quite a healthy one. We don't plan on being around forever. And the liberated method is absolutely It's contingent on helping people access their own agency and to build their own self up, not to be consumers of services. But we know in the first instance they need a load of input, and most of it is non-specialist, but it's really, really key. So if you look at this and you think of it in terms of consumption, it's a bargain. This thing costs nowhere near as much as lots of reductionist interventions and lots of referrals. It blows it out of the water. So the case I know best, which isn't this one, but is similar, you know, the guy that was with this three people who we've costed in lots and lots of detail, and they're all well over £1 million worth of consumption over 8-9 years. And we've gone, you know, I mean, certainly in the second year for one of them, the resource consumption is like barely a tenth of what it would have been if we'd have kept on going. But what we've done is a lot of stuff that is, like I say, it's very, very contextual. It's, some people even say it's touchy-feely and it's all a bit woolly. Well, do you know what? Yeah, it probably is, because sometimes that's what you need. If we've got a system that's incapable of reading between the lines being specialisms, and we think that people's solutions are an aggregation of specialisms that are essentially arbitrary, we're kidding ourselves. It's not how people work. That's complicated, but people are complex, and that difference between complicated and complex is all the stuff the teams do that is non-specialist. Whether it's going to an appointment with somebody who's struggling, or sitting somebody down and saying, can we talk about what's going on here? Or being a bit firm with them. We talk about high support and high challenge. Because you've got the relationship, you can do that. It's like, you can't carry on like this. And that kind of nuance saves an absolute fortune. But we've designed public services to be the deployers of specialisms. And whilst that's important, it's not the only show in town, and we've proven that. So what I would encourage people to think about when they're listening to this is, if this was normal and in deploying your particular specialism, you had context, which is what I think the workers are bringing. They're bringing context. Would your decisions be different? Particularly if you had faith that you probably wouldn't see nearly as much of them in the future because it's kind of working. And what we're finding is that's absolutely the case. People are making slightly different decisions. As Tori said, they're reading between the lines. They're thinking outside the box a bit. And it just saves so much time. Because if the thing about the people that we're working with is, it does sound quite slow work, doesn't it? You know, 18 months with... But 18 months compared to the years of suffering and consumption is nothing. It's nothing. We've got to start thinking about why we all get out of bed in the morning, what this work's all about, and it's about this. We've just lost our way, but I think we've got the people we need. We've got the empathy, we've got the skills we need. We're just kind of deploying them a bit erroneously, and it racks up just so much cost. One of the things that we want to do is obviously want to grow this, and I think we've already got a very strong business case for doing that. So I guess it appeals to I'm going to overgeneralise here, but if you were to think very sort of left, liberal, touchy-feely, this work is really appealing because it's about people nurturing people and understanding them and working with them. If you were to think very right, a centre, very hard-nosed economic, it still makes sense. You know, why would you not want to say double-digit percentages and have better outcomes? So we think there's a strong, politically agnostic business case for doing this sort of stuff. And it does... I think the issue about saving money, and this is the crucial thing, is that if you look at it through the prism of one budget, you'll either win or you'll lose. You've got to look at it as a system, as an ecosystem. Everybody wins if everybody wins. So if it turns out that, so in the example that I was quoting before, the increase in expenditure would have been in housing. But by spending that money in housing, you're saving absolutely thousands in health, social care and criminal justice. So this guy, 3,500 interactions over, I think it was 9 years, 1,000 plus in the health system, 1,000 plus in the criminal justice system, they've gone to virtually zero because we spent a bit more money on housing. So what the leadership needs to be capable of is saying, how can we move the money around to where it needs to be and get rid of this, what I would call a financial stalemate, whereby, well, if it's not, if my budget doesn't win, nobody wins, even if there's a net gain for all of us to be had. So in all these discussions about value and cost, the disconnect is that we know it's better and it's cheaper in the round. The question is, are we capable and willing to look at it in the round? Because it's the only way this is going to perpetuate. And right now we're not, are we? We're very obsessed with our own budgets. So part of my mission, from a leadership point of view, is to say, how do we change that? And that's why we're getting so many partners involved, because if we can demonstrate that ultimately everybody does win, but okay, on one case it might be you that foots a bit more of the bill, but in others you'll make a packet or save a packet, then that's what we've got to do. We've got to create the conditions for that to be normal. So that's what we do after Changing Futures. What Changing Futures is doing is demonstrating that that's the right thing to do.
And it's a bit like the question I've been asked, how can you operationalise it? Because it's seen as a project, time limited. How does it evolve from that into what we would call, and it's probably, unhelpful.
The thing to remember is it's a method.
Yeah.
It's a project because we're having to test the method. It's not a service. So the question isn't, how do we build a change of future service in our organisation? The question is, how do we deploy the liberated method in our organisation? It's a method. And if you have that alongside your specialisms, you will benefit, for sure. But it's a big cultural shift. It requires the money to work differently, commissioning needs to work differently because you need to learn. As Tori said, and as she said as well, it's a learning programme. So how do you commission for learning rather than just a delivery mindset? All that stuff needs to be factored in.
Yeah, thank you. So I just wanted to go back as well to any other examples, any other where you both collectively, Rasheen and Tori, feel like you've seen the benefits of this. For one, you don't see them again, Rasheen, but also anyone that you wanted to pick out that was meaningful. And I'm going to use the term, they were a patient. I know we see them as also as citizens, but and the one that you wanted to pick up that.
Got a few, haven't I?
Yeah. I think there's a couple that I can think of that are doing really, really. There's one guy in particular at the minute who's doing really, really well, and I don't believe you've seen him again since he came in there, since he joined the programme.
I think when he first joined, there was a couple of little attendances, but I haven't seen him in well over 12 months.
And again, he was one of your most frequent.
Someone that was seen, I would say, every week.
Yeah.
And
this guy wouldn't leave the house. He wouldn't leave the house. And it was lonely. The loneliness was his biggest presenting issue, I would say. Obviously, that's not what he was coming into the hospital with. It would be self-harm and alcohol.
And falls. And I think for us as a team, it's obviously that's part of what we do, seeing people in A&E when they're at crisis point and unwell, but to then not see someone and know that they're doing really well, that's a great thing. It's a great outcome for us, and obviously him being part of the programme has been beneficial for him and getting him to achieve his goal.
And I think that's a big with this guy So his caseworker and peer specialist, because he wouldn't leave the house, so they kept going to Terry's house, did home visits, probably in touch with him every day, just gradually got to know him, gradually built that relationship up, and slowly supported him to get out of the house. And it was, and again, it's the time, and it's having that time to dedicate to it. But it started off taking him to groups. Because connection, what it was, the biggest thing he needed was connection. His wife had passed away. He'd lost contact with his family through the drinking. So they gradually took him to groups, and then that evolved to they would go into the groups with him. Then they were dropping him off at the group and picking him up. Then they were just picking him up, and that it was a really slow process. And at the minute now, they see him once every fortnight, just to touch base, to keep in touch, because they'll ring him now and he'll go, I haven't got time. He's part of AA, he's part of a number of groups around, I think it's Sunderland he lives in, and he doesn't have to, and that's
that is ideal, and that's what. So when you're saying about this being expensive, it's actually not in. So in terms of he's not coming to the hospital multiple times a week, and that we're not even seeing him because he's regained his relationships with his family. He now goes and sees his grandson play football. He's part of all these communities, these recovery communities. He's another lovely example of someone who's benefited really like so much from this work. Mm. We've got another guy
who we referred in who frequently attended A&E, intoxicated, overdose, or with police. He then was obviously picked up by the programme, but he was really difficult to contact. He had no mobile phone, he was living in one of the hostels. So the workhouse obviously eventually got contacted with him, and then he went to rehab and he's now living somewhere different, alcohol and drug free, and doing really, really well, and we haven't seen him since.
Yeah.
Which is
I don't know, this number may be maybe out of date, but I remember fairly early on when you were talking to the team in Sunderland South Tyneside, and I was listening in, and you'd said something like the amount of admissions from this cohort gone down by was like 70-odd% or something. Is that still about the case?
Yeah, so I think initially the first couple of patients that were referred on the programme, I had looked at their admissions or attendances to A&E in like a 12-month period before, and then we did from them going into the programme, and there was all of them had had a huge reduction in attendances. I think everyone that's gone on the programme has, really. Yeah. If not from attending to totally not attending.
Yeah, because one of the things that's worth mentioning is that, not through this, but this is a perfect example of it, in the homelessness touch point, there was a guy who presented as homeless, that's how we got to know him, but it just so happened that he was the most frequent attender at A&E in Gateshead. And then he stopped turning up because the guys were working with him and he's done really well. And we forget the reason, but we had cause to be talking to the couple of the consultants up in A&E there. And we'd said, oh yeah, we know him and he's fine. And they were like, oh, we thought he'd died. Because that's in their frequent attender list, that's how you come off it, basically. And he was top. I think he had 120 attendances in the 5 months or something before we got involved, and I think 7 in a year after, and no admissions. And they were like, well, we've got a team here that deals with frequent attenders, but all they do is get them in and get them out quick. They pay attention to them while they're here, and that's not saying that's unreasonable, but they're not stopping them coming because they're in the hospital. By the time they're working with them, they're already in the hospital. So, long story short, they got a bit excited and we ended up setting a touch point up there. We hadn't designed that in the bid, but we had capacity to do so, so we set one up there. And we're just hearing now, because that's a newer one, that certainly there's only a handful of cases that we've dealt with in that touch point thus far, but every single one of them has come off the frequent attender list, and yet these people have been on this list for years and have just been handled by this team. So there is definitely something about holistic relational working that prevents demand, and the health service needs to know how to prevent demand. I mean, I'm not in it, but I know that much. So there's definitely something about this works in multiple settings, because the issues transcend those settings, they really are about people. So I think if we can knit all that together, we've got a chance.
Yeah, and I've seen it, I've been to them myself. We have, you know, what do you call it? It's called high intense users as well, so there's high intense users. Mm-hmm. There's an alcohol element to it in the meeting, they're often to do with violence, people, you know, patients that turn up and violence is involved in their attendance or why they've attended. Mm-hmm. But I guess the thing I was going to ask from that was the other approaches that often referred to and are advocating, the high intense user approach is an approach. It's got a, yeah, a set of processes and yeah, steps yeah. in it. And I've also had, in discussing this with clinicians, it referred to things like assertive outreach, for example, as a, well, isn't this just assertive outreach? And I've had, had to kind of differentiate something that's, you know, formulated in a different way to what the liberated method looks like.
I would say the key difference is again, it's the role of context. So the liberated method doesn't have any pathways, protocols or procedures. It just has rules and principles. Three rules, five principles, that's it. So the work, you work outwards from the person. You don't, you, there's no eligibility really. It can, you can do this for anyone. So whilst this project is focused on people with particularly acute and complex multiple needs, we've done this work with people that are struggling with debt. We've done this people with in other settings, and it's worked. And various other things too, you know. So the difference really for us is that this is essentially about working outwards from that person, and it was always going to be different every single time. So this idea of bespoke by default. Whereas other processes are of the system, they're designed in the context of it, they'll have pathways in there, and this just doesn't. And the notion of assertiveness, say assertive outreach, well, this is, there's no assertiveness to this at all. This is basically saying, we'll meet you where you're at. And it may well be that most of your issues aren't health related. It's fine. Because the scope is, one of the five principles is the scope of the work is set by the relationship between the citizen and the workers. So they'll agree what the scope of the work is. So for some people that's carpentry, poetry, dog grooming. It could be anything. And it should be if it's relevant. And it's not, we're not, outreach implies we're here and we're going there. It's a bit, we're here. Whereas what this is, well, we'll just be wherever you are, and that's the essence of it. So it isn't about doing what we do now a bit better. It's about doing totally different stuff, yeah. I would argue. And it's agnostic of the system at the moment. It's just, it's all about the people.
Yeah. probably good to have another example, because you said there's loads of examples. There's another one that we could pick out that's...
Yeah, poignant. There's another guy who joined the programme, when would that have been? Who was heavily involved in the criminal justice system. So he... I can't remember exactly when it was.
It was before Christmas, yeah. September, October time.
Yeah, and I think not long after he came on the programme, he was up on remand for a number of offences that he'd committed previous to this. So we did, we still worked with him with this, they went and visited him in prison, got to know him still, and as he was coming out, they actually went to court with him, and just by chance the barrister who was representing them had caught them outside of the, just chatting to them like who they were and what they were doing, and heard a little bit about the programme. So when they were in court, he'd said, put them on the spot a bit and said, you know, he's just been referred to this programme called Changing Futures. So the judge actually got one of them on the stand and said, tell us, yeah, pressure, just tell it. And at the minute, at that point, we didn't actually know the guy too well. He had, we had just started getting to know him. So just very honestly said exactly that, that this is what we were going to do. He went to prison just as we were getting to know him, but this is what the programme can offer, and this is what we do. The judge was absolutely blown away, and actually deferred his prison sentence for 3 months and said, you've got a gift here, you've got a chance, we're going to give you 3 months, we'll catch up with you, we'll release you, catch up with you in 3 months' time, work with these guys, and we'll review it in 3 months' time, and if you can keep out of trouble, then that'll be great. So they did some really good work with them in that time, and got them into some temporary accommodation. That was a real struggle. Unfortunately, some historic offences have come back again, but again he's up in court, and the judge wants the Change in Futures workers to be part of that. Wow. Very, very keen to work to like see how this work can change things, because he was doing really well. I don't know what did he have any?
I think in between
that 3 month period we did see him. I haven't seen him recently, but this was someone that we could see on a morning and then they could be back again on the night time in the ED.
Which site was he?
Sunderland.
Sunderland, right.
Mm-hmm. And when he was there, he was very challenging. It was really difficult because he was aggressive, or he was obviously highly intoxicated and under the influence of substances. But it's obviously good to hear of the chance that he's being given, and we haven't had as much or seen him as much since he started the programme.
I guess they're different when they're in the programme, but they do still come to ED. You've got a bit of, you know, if they do come to the hospital and you know that they're part of this programme, you've got another bit of a support mechanism. Or
yeah, so if any of the patients come that are in the programme and they're admitted, either the caseworkers will ring us to say they're on their way because they know they're coming in, or we'll contact them with to say that they're in. And obviously they'll come, we'll support them in going to see the patients, or and vice versa, the patients getting in contact with them if needed.
We've got a really good relationship, haven't we? The two teams have got we've built a really good relationship, mm-hmm. so there's really good communication there, and I do think it's support for both, and it's good. It really works for us when they have come into hospital, because then we can get in touch. And
we have had some quite complex situations that have happened when the patients have been in hospital, and to navigate, like when we've had NDTs and there's been decisions to be made about medical treatment, and there's been all sorts of different things happen. So it is good that the support workers and the caseworkers can come in, and ACT can support them with that and being part of that with the patient as well. And I get lots of good feedback from the patients about the programme and the workers, which is good.
Yeah, I know that's something I've heard you say, Mark, a bit about the feedback you get from the people that have gone through the Liberated Method.
Yeah, I think there's two sources of feedback. Well, they all matter, but there's two that really matter. One is the people themselves that have gone through it, who, you know, they're told, people have said that they'd be dead if it wasn't for this, or they'd be in prison or whatever. And we can see the trajectory, and that doesn't strike me as an exaggeration. And so I'm always heartened by that. We get fan mail. We've had letters and cards and all sorts, you know. And how many public services get fan mail? You're not many. Certainly not why we do it. It's really lovely when it happens. The other feedback that really value is that of people that are in the system but not in the programme. So Rasheen, perfect example, you're connected to the work, and I'm always heartened to listen to you speak about this. But I think when we get, I've had social workers who initially were very sceptical and probably threatened by this. You know, I'm the social worker, well, you're not qualified. You're not the commissioned service, nor are you qualified. What do you know? And then eventually the value of the relational approach comes through, and they'll say things like, well, based on your existence, I can make better decisions. You're not only reducing demand into this service, but I know a bunch of things that the assessment would never have told me, because you understood rather than assessed. When I get feedback like that from professionals within the system, managers, workers, whatever, I realise that two things. A, this works, and it's really heartening. But the other thing is that whenever, and a lot of people in management positions out there will recognise this, whenever there's a compulsion to do some improvement, the first thing we'll reach for is the structure chart, and we'll do a restructure. And what I would say is resist the urge, because in all the work that we're doing and listening to Sheena and Tori talking then, what they've done, you've built a relationship. The structure is irrelevant. The relationship is everything. It transcends the structure. So you can pretty much make any structure work, provided you get the relationships right. And the feedback we get from professionals nails that for me. And it's really helpful for me to sort of focus on, well, I'm not going to put the spanner there. I'm going to put the spanner over there where the method is key, not the structure. I'm not going to conflate those two things. Yeah. And that's brilliant. So feedback is heartening and it makes you feel good. But more than that, it makes you learn. And even when it doesn't work, well, people aren't engaging, or it's just something's backfired or someone's relapsed, the feedback we get always helps us to learn. And one of the things that Tori oversees, and it's critical, is that because this is a learning programme, there's a lot of infrastructure in the way the teams operate around learning. That's massively important. Group supervision, one-to-one supervision, case review, all of that stuff is really, really key. So our feedback that we get gets wrapped into that process. We don't just put it on the wall and smile at it. You know, it's really important that we do something with it. So I think, I mean, that's something that Tori's close to than me, but the principle when we set this up was that we built learning in.
Yeah.
Can't learn without feedback.
No. And it feels like a given almost. I was going to ask the question, is it going to benefit other groups of, and I'm going to use different, you know, groups of patients or people with different problems? It feels like we've kind of talked around it does, but how was the method, what you're doing, kind of branching into other organisations that are,
well,
even local?
People are pulling hard for it. I think what's happening is they're hearing the stories or they're seeing the data or a bit of both, and there's a lot of curiosity. So we've had a bit of a mantra around this, that it's attraction, not persuasion. What we don't want to do is start shoving this down people's throats, but what we are inviting is curiosity. And we've had loads of interest from policing, from the wider ICB, from mental health. We're actually starting to do a piece of work with CNTW at the moment, and from all sorts of other organisations and other councils around this. We think there's scope for this to benefit people, not just those with multiple and complex needs, it's just those that are on the cusp of services, if you like, those that are kind of, that aren't eligible. Actually, what we're starting to create is a sort of a bit of momentum around saying, well, why, rather than say come back when you're worse, let's actually think about how we can work with you now in a bespoke, non-specialist way and see what happens. So we're getting people from overseas interested in the work, because I think this move towards a relational approach is for whatever reason, it's coming off the back of lots of countries going down an austerity route. I think this stands to benefit an awful lot of people if we can get it right. But it is very different. That's the challenge. It is pretty different.
And I think from on the ground, people are crying out for it, so I think Rashina will back us up on this one. So what we try to do with everyone that we support is, one of the first things we do is get anyone who's involved in their support around the table. Mm-hmm. So we'll pull them all together and have a professionals meeting just to see what people are doing, how we can help, how we can complement the work that's going on, and everyone will say to me, I've got somebody, how do I refer? Everyone from substance misuse services, social services, the police, probation, everyone is desperately saying, please, but I've got this person. Yeah, how do I refer them in?
I get people ringing me up asking if I can refer someone on their behalf.
So I'll say, sorry, we'll only take people from the alcohol care team, so then we'll get on to Rushing.
Well, I think that's the question I was asked you all generally, but Mark as well, what does this look like in the future? What does, you know, and it feels like there's a prosperous future for it, but You did previously tell me an example where you had an organisation where you felt you were going to go in and help them, but actually they said, no, we want to be able to do this ourselves. And exactly. That's kind of the difference.
That's key. It's a method. I do not want to grow a Change in Future service. I really don't. I think the only thing I'm prepared to do that's structurally additional is an institute which enables people to develop this method. And if we do that well, it shouldn't be permanent. I acknowledge the fact that we're so far through the looking glass when it comes to kind of standardised transactional design, that we're busy with that and demand's going up. So organisations are going to need specific identifiable resources to help them with it. They can't do it in their spare time. This programme is a small example of probably something that can help an organisation move from purely transactional stuff to relational stuff, and I think that's what it's going to take. So we're talking about developing an institute for prevention and reform, so the preventative side of this work is really strong, but you need reform to make it normal. If we can build that so that people can pull on it and use it, then the way I see it is that, like I said before, I'm not that bothered about what the structures look like. I wouldn't come along to see your structure, to our care team or to the trust and say your structure's all wrong. I don't care about structure. Whatever your structure is, how can we make sure this method is part of what you do? And so if I take a counter, I know councils better than I know health organisations. We'll take, I'll just pick on housing because it's a really, not Gateshead housing, particularly just the concept of it. So housing is predicated on managing stock and managing tenancies. And in order to do that, you have a load of people in different disparate jobs like housing officers and rent officers and rent and income officers and advice and support people and all these various delineations. And my take on that is, they all need to do this. And they only need to go where they're needed. And they need data intelligence to know which doors to knock on or to deal with presentations. If housing does that, they will see better, longer tenancies, less damage, less repairs, more stability. At the moment, it's really reductionist, and we'll just tackle the debt rent arrears over here, we'll tackle the repair over here, and on it goes. And they won't really connect easily with other bits of the system. So I would want it to look, in housing, I'd want it to look like the liberated method is part of what housing do. Same as it is in machine steam, connecting to the Tories staff. There needs to be something where it's built in. So absolutely not interested in empire building. But what we do need is this method to perpetuate and proliferate. That's the key. So the leadership challenge is, how do we turn this method on? And I think it's very doable because we've seen the benefits and we've seen that over time it'll take costs down.
And that isn't a random example. There has been a shown to be a definite link between housing and health.
Massive.
And how they can
increasingly
interdependencies of those two things. One can create the other.
Yeah, I mean, there's a really stark example like Awab's law that's coming in around the mould and stuff like that. So a poor boy in Rochdale that lost his life because it was on his death certificate and it's prompted loss. That's a really, I suppose, a linear example of problem. And cause and problem. But what it betrays is this deeper relationship between housing and health. And I think we need to really take it seriously. So we've talked again about somewhere to live, someone to love and something to do. The loneliness, the housing and the connection. If all public services had a mind to think about those three things, no matter what specialism, then I think we're in business. I was talking to another trust last Friday. They were having a strategy away day, and one of the things they said, I'm paraphrasing but only slightly, was we've spent the last few years focusing on building hospitals and creating capacity, and all we've done is fill it. What we now need to do is work out why it's full. And I thought it was a really interesting statement, and that's why he pulled on us, because he would say, could you come and talk to our team about how we might actually focus on achieving our purpose, which isn't just to fill our hospitals up. And I thought it was really telling that that's starting to kick in now. The curiosity is very much more about context rather than flow, and it's more about people than it is about buildings.
Yeah.
So keep that change going, and I think this method's very conducive to making it happen.
Yeah. Great, thank you very much, everyone. I just wanted to, I suppose, end with that. I know there's been some growth in the interest in this, and you've had a conference recently in the area that's been well attended. And
it's amazing.
I guess the things that are going to develop from that, and I suppose the people listening, how can they find out more about this? And
we've got a website, so Changing Futures Northumbria. If you search that, you'll find it, and on there there's a description of the liberated method and of the project. There's also some articles which goes into depth about the method, the institute we're looking to build, and various other things. And just contact us if you want to know more. So just I'm at Gateshead Council, so just if you just email mark.asmith@gateshead.gov.uk, I can answer questions. But just or go through the contact form on our website. But there's loads of information on there.
Great. We'll put a link at the bottom, so that'll be easier to access. But Mark, Rasheen, Tori, thank you very much for your time, and thanks for that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of our People Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it, and check out our other stories. Hit subscribe to keep up to date with the latest and catch up with what we've been up to on our Twitter, Facebook and Instagram pages. Just search for our name.